From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Political commentator turned historian Kevin Phillips famously concerns himself with the way societies are constituted and divided and politically realigned. He worked for Richard Nixon, foretold a Republican rise, then turned away from it. Now he's looking all the way back to the American Revolution and the forces that made it happen. They come together in 1775, he says. We read them at a new time of American ferment. This hour on Point, Kevin Phillips on American Revolution 1775 and politics then and now. You can join the conversation. What can we still learn from America's days of revolution from 1775? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is the celebrated political strategist and analyst turned historian, Kevin Phillips, one-time Republican White House strategist, now a fierce critic of his first party and American politics in general. He wrote the groundbreaking 1969 book, The Emerging Republican Majority, and many more since. His latest, his new one, is 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. Kevin Phillips, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
It's very nice to see you. They get the musical, they get the song and dance, they get the fireworks, they have the Declaration of Independence in 76. You're looking more deeply than that. Why does this still matter to Americans, the precise, exact understanding that you're looking to convey here of the roots of our revolution?
Well, if you're a history buff, the subject may fascinate you in its own right. But for people who wonder about the contemporary relevance, I would say that the big lesson it suggests, anything important that happens in government and politics is generally much more complicated than it sometimes seems. And I think that the problems we face today are a bit like 1776. They're met with slogans. Everybody has nice things to say. Of course we're going to solve this problem. The nitty-gritty, meanwhile, they haven't paid any attention to. And it's the nitty-gritty that the whole period in the early revolution suggests is extraordinarily important, and then you need to pay more attention to it.
Is it just a nitty-gritty for revolutionaries that you're looking at here? I mean, you've got Tea Party people out and about today, or is it a nitty-gritty for any kind of political movement, aspiration?
Well, the interesting question today in the minds of some of the Tea Party people and some of the people on the other side of the fence, the Occupy Wall Street crowd and such like, is whether the country isn't tipping towards some revolution. Now, they don't say it would be violent, but some of them maybe think it's going to go a little further than what we see. I don't think so. I don't think that whether it's the Tea Party or the equivalents on the left have any great potential to move into a genuine revolutionary mode. But I think it's important to understand that between passivity and a real revolution, there is an engaged, activist, worried, concerned, participatory citizenry mindful of the problems and the depth of the crisis. That's what we need. I'm not sure we have it.
I want to get to this history, but that may be relevant given you've done a lot of analysis in recent years saying the great United States of America is a great power in decline. It almost sounds as though we need a kind of revolutionary effort, if not a revolution, just to turn that around, in your view.
Well, one of the reasons that I decided to spend 4 years working on this book was that I had spent probably 15 years off and on talking about the threat to the United States of following in the footsteps of the Dutch and the British and other previous global hegemons who let themselves become too financial and too overextended and too much in debt. And I got tired of talking about it because you could talk about it and nothing happened. As far as I'm concerned, it's still basically true. I haven't gone back into the mode of talking about it, but I do think it's still basically true. We have a big problem.
Okay, let's dive into the history. And the first thing that got my attention, there are many things here. I found this really fascinating, but these days, the American Revolution is used, and the Founding Fathers and all the rest, as a touchstone for ideology very often, as a kind of reference point for people who want to bolster a contemporary case about ideology. You write that ideology was by no means the most important element here. You say even that at some point in here that you write about ideology kind of reluctantly. Why? What does that
mean?
Well,
I'm reluctant to write about ideology when I'm analyzing a realignment or a watershed in political history, because generally the average person doesn't react to ideology. They react to a lot more of other things, whether it's religion, ethnicity, economics, sectionalism, wars, but not to ideology.
Liberty?
Liberty, yes. Now, liberty is a sense of a personal deprivation or threat to the person. Liberty people react to. I'm talking about abstract ideology. A lot of people think that the revolution was a battle fought with ideas. I don't think so, really. They were there, but they were not the movers. And that's
a big difference. The pamphleteers, the Thomas Paines.
Well, Thomas Paine, I think, had a big influence because he wasn't an idea man. He was a grudge man. He described George III in sitting around the table language, which the double domes, to refer to the people who had all these sense of the great importance of various 17th and 18th century English thinkers. I mean, they were irrelevant. What Thomas Paine said, this king is a bum, basically. I don't refer to that. I don't think of that as ideology.
Liberty is not ideology, the push for liberty. I mean, in a period where the crown ruled, isn't speaking of liberty itself, whether personal or national? Wasn't that an ideological push?
Generally speaking, the liberties in question that people were worried about, they were worried about religious liberties in some cases. You had state churches. They were worried about economic liberties because the whole imperial system regulated the economy so much and so painfully. Mm-hmm. They were worried about personal movement liberties. The British were trying to keep people from moving west to the Appalachians. Mm-hmm. They were worried about just their culture in a lot of ways, especially if, for example, they were foreigners who had arrived, and a lot of people in 1775 were first-generation Americans.
And foreigners, what are you defining that as, Americans who were recent immigrants or Americans not of English origin? How are you defining foreigners?
Well, those two categories would overlap a lot because mm-hmm. a lot of the people coming into the colonies after the 1720s and 30s, mm-hmm. and especially in the 10 years before the revolution, were people who came from Europe, often from areas where they had an affectionate view of England because they were, say, Protestant Germans mm-hmm. who were favored by the crown. This sense of liberty, in some cases, they felt much less threatened by the crown than by the patriot leaders who they thought were, let's say, militant Presbyterians.
Well, let's talk about that. You say that the America's Revolutionary War was in many ways a civil war. What do you mean by that, Kevin?
Well, absolutely. Now, just to go back very briefly to a book that I wrote 15 years ago called The Cousins mm-hmm. Wars, and it was about the three major English-speaking civil wars, the English Revolution of the 1640s, the American Revolution, and the American Civil War. They all had a number of things in common, alignments, certain ways of approaching issues, and certain persisting cleavages between groups. So, yes, I would say the American Revolution was a civil war. It wasn't too apparent in 1775, except in a few places, like South Carolina. You could see it in western Connecticut. It was shaping up in the Hudson Valley in New York. But it became much clearer later as the British moved in that you really had civil war potential, and it occurred.
Meaning, so within the revolution, or a part and parcel of it, was tension, conflict between the inhabitants of this continent themselves.
Well, flat-out conflict. One of the interesting sets of data is several historians have tabulated how many battles, and I'm including small battles, were fought between colonials, loyalists on one side and patriots on the other side. Never had a British soldier involved.
And the lines of tension there were regional, economic, Cultural? Who lined up on either side of these civil
Basically,
conflicts?
I would say E, all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
What you had in colonies like South Carolina, in the Piedmont, it had been filled up in the previous 25 years by migrants coming south for the most part from other colonies. And they had a whole lot of different grudges, but basically, again, ethnicity and religion, also a lot of economic sense of being discriminated against by the people who ran South Carolina.
The Lowlanders, who were in the vanguard of the Patriot
Revolution.
Yes,
absolutely. So if you had the plantation class in coastal South Carolina running the revolution, a lot of these people in the backcountry felt discriminated against by them, so they leaned toward the king's side.
Kevin Phillips, stand by. The new book is 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Kevin, I'm going to torture you with a little music from 1776, the musical. Kevin Phillips makes the other case. Join us. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Come ye cool, cool, considerate set. We'll dance together to the same minuet. To the right, ever to the right, never to the left. Forever to the right. Let our creed be never to exceed regulated speed, no matter what the need. Come sing Hosanna, Hosanna. Emblazoned on our banner is keep cool.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the American Revolution, the year 1775. And American politics then and now with big historian, analyst Kevin Phillips. His new book is 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. Kevin Phillips joins me in the studio. You're very clear that there were colonies, now states most of them, in the vanguard and others who weren't. In the vanguard, you put Virginia and Connecticut and South Carolina, the lowlanders anyway, and maybe above all, Massachusetts and Boston. Describe the colonies that were out front and why versus those who weren't and why not.
Well, a number of yardsticks give you this list. First of all, they were the most active, the earliest. You can see them getting front and center in 1774, even more so in 1775. They were the older colonies. They had the longest standing charters. In many cases, they were given rights that extended to the Pacific, so they had a great sense of manifest destiny, even before that was a slogan. They had pretty finely developed governments, which important parts of which were controlled by the colonists and governors. When there were royal governors, couldn't stop them. They had, in a number of cases, a great interest in land speculation beyond their own boundaries. They had a large record of having been involved in foreign military campaigns in the sense of fighting in the Caribbean or in Canada, standing off the French or the Spanish. They had their own foreign policies. They had their own policies and negotiations with neighboring Indian tribes. They were much more than the equivalent of an English shire or a county. They were little countries.
So what was going – well, I guess before I go there, and the colonies who did not fall in that vanguard, what were the dynamics that were making them more complacent or less interested in revolution?
Well, the most important dynamic was
– we're talking New York here, Pennsylvania, Maryland.
Well, there are two categories that didn't go into the vanguard. One category was simply being too small or too much in the shadow of another major colony so that you didn't matter too much. Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Georgia, in some respects New Jersey. The important category were large colonies that were not in the vanguard because they were conflicted, and that's New York and Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Conflicted for a number of reasons. They had a very mixed, heterogeneous, both religiously and ethnically. They had a lot of loyalists. They had a lot of people who liked the British Empire.
Pennsylvania Quakers. They were indebted to the Empire.
Pennsylvania Quakers. Basically, Pennsylvania was organized given by the crown to the Quakers for all practical purposes. They trusted the Quakers a lot more than they trusted the Yankee Congregationalists or the Presbyterians in Pennsylvania. But part of what impacted Pennsylvania and New York was they had a sense of a future in the British Empire. People were talking about how fast the population was growing in the 13 colonies. Mm-hmm. And if you were in New England or the southern plantation colonies, you were never going to be the kingpin of the British Empire. But if you were in New York or Philadelphia, you could imagine that a century hence, the British Empire might have swung so that the population center was in the New World. Believe me, people wrote about this.
It might revolve around you, even
yes,
from the New World.
Exactly.
The Gotham became the world capital in another way entirely. So take us into the groundwork that was being laid in 1775, which you say is really the story of the revolution that we saw blossom in all the 1776 moments that we're so familiar with. What were the most important pieces being laid down in this revolutionary more than run-up?
Well, there's so many of them that it's a little hard to give them the time they deserve. The first thing that was happening, which I can sum up very quickly, was that the colonies were engaged in a massive hunt for the gunpowder and cannon they would need to fight the revolution, and the crown was engaged in a very strong attempt to keep them from getting this gunpowder and cannon.
Lexington and Concord, just one kind of outgrowth of this, but it's a global competition.
Global competition, and as early as October of 1774, King George moved to prohibit munitions being taken in a British ship to the colonies unless it was by government order. They were very mindful of all of this. People in Rhode Island and New Hampshire, way before Lexington and Concord, seized cannon and gunpowder from the royal forts in December 1774. So that was a major event that was shaping the revolution that gets almost no attention, this quest for gunpowder and cannon.
And what you call a rage militaire sweeping the colonies. Even fashion became militaristic.
Yes. And that started to develop in New England and in Virginia in the autumn of 1774 when they were starting to put together a major emphasis on militia organization, on minutemen. Again, most conspicuous in New England, but very visible in the plantation counties, too.
Specifically for the purpose of revolution? Was that clear to their own minds at that point?
Well, you can fairly ask whether they thought they would be fighting the British. And I would say, I think in their heart of hearts, a lot of them did. Mm-hmm. You don't mobilize the way Connecticut and Massachusetts mobilized without knowing who your enemy was likely to be. Mm-hmm. And the same for Virginia.
Take us on through the list of big tracks being laid down in 75.
Well, one of the most important was in the First Continental Congress that met in September and October of 1774. They met in response to the Boston Tea Party having prompted the British to pass what were called the Coercive Acts aimed at Massachusetts. And it backfired on the British badly because a lot of the other colonies took the side of Massachusetts, and they had their own ulterior motive in the South. They wanted to tie in policy towards Britain with a consumer boycott of British goods, mm-hmm, and a threat to use the commodities like tobacco and rice in South Carolina as a major bludgeon with which to pressure the British to give in to colonial opinion. And all this was developed almost a declaration of economic war in October 1774. The British started counter-mobilizing, considering it as an almost declaration of war, and they put together a countervailing set of policies basically to stop the colonists trading anywhere but Britain and the colonies in the Caribbean and to block the colonists from fishing in the North Atlantic fisheries. And these pieces of legislation were put through Parliament in March and April of 1775 before Lexington and Concord,
mm-hmm,
so that you had the two sides were getting ready to fight an economic war.
it was getting so hot that the British governors were fleeing the mainland. They were fleeing to British frigates, ships offshore for their own safety.
By the summer of 1775, you had a number of governors either fled to a British warship or to a major British merchantman in the harbors, with the case of Governor Tryon in New York. Several others were under the equivalent of house arrest. For example, the governor in New Jersey, William Franklin, was Ben Franklin's son. They didn't want to force him out, but they made it impossible for him to carry out his office. And finally, they did force him out.
And all over the colonies, or in the vanguard anyway, sort of local government was taking over, very effective, and pursuing loyalty oaths to a new regime that were no joke.
Well, there were two levels of new government put into position in 74 and 75. The first was that most of the colonies set up provincial congresses or provincial conventions to sidestep the part of government controlled by the British. The second thing was that the Continental Congress, in setting up all these trade threats and mechanisms in October 1774, also called on towns and counties to set up local committees to carry out these boycotts and trade-related measures. And they were in place, 800 or 900 of them, by the spring of 1775. They were, in essence, the county governments of the Patriot Movement.
I mean, I was so impressed here. But if you want to do something big, you've got to lay a lot of groundwork. And a lot of groundwork was very deliberately laid in these material ways around economics, around local self-government, also in shaping the narrative. Well, what went on? You talk about ships out of New England, out of Salem, racing to London with the news of Concord and Lexington much more quickly than the British themselves could get the word out, so they could shape the story of what was happening globally.
Well, that was a brilliant move by Sam Adams, John Hancock and company. Essentially, I think they had the script of Lexington and Concord written before even Lexington and Concord happened. Sam Adams had been out in Lexington the night before. Nobody knows quite what he said, but I suspect he was doing a little plotting. They obviously got even British soldiers that were captured to say that the British fired first. All of this was prepared and sent to Philadelphia by couriers almost immediately, and it was also sent to London almost immediately. They got a fast ship, the Derbys, up in Salem.
Big shipping family.
Yes, and they made it in like 24 days, and Gage, the British military governor in Boston, was a slug of bed. He took his time. It took two more weeks after the colonial version got to London for the British version to arrive, and it was a disaster for the crown.
So we think of ourselves as these days as masters of information flow, and the Pentagon always thinks about it, but here you are in 1775 already right on that task. Let's get a call from Salem, where those Derby ships went out of. Chris is calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air with Kevin Phillips.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think Mr. Phillips makes a great point, or at least at the time when I was calling in saying that the royal governors were being targeted. But I think it's also important to note that it wasn't just the royal people at that high governmental level that were being targeted by the increasingly militant patriot insurgency, even prior to 1775, but it was almost anyone that was loyal to the crown, but especially the people at those high governmental levels. And I think that also speaks to that distinction that he was making earlier, that the revolution and what I would say developed into the war of the revolution, and then finally a war for independence, 1776 on, became an increasingly brutal civil war.
Chris, I'm glad you raised it. What about that aspect? It wasn't just royal governors who were having to flee and watch out. That tension, that very real threat if you weren't on the right side in your zone.
Well, they were among the most conspicuous because in some of these colonies, there wasn't much government below the royal governor's level because it was so much controlled by the local power structure. But that's absolutely right, especially in Massachusetts and South Carolina, where they had a lot of royal appointees or loyalist appointees. And it was certainly true in Massachusetts.
How did that manifest itself?
Well, even by late 1774, a number of the targets of the Patriot movement, office holders, fled.
I mean, would the committee show up at your gate with torches, or how did you get the word that you had to go?
Well, they did better than that. They did show up sometimes with torches, but they had, in the summer of 1774, huge meetings in towns like Worcester and Springfield, where they had 4,000 or 5,000 people demonstrating, including hundreds of militiamen organized by companies led by their officers. It became clear to the British government, to General Gage in Boston, and all of these counselors and justices of the peace and lower court judges, they had to get out.
Let's go to Harry in Burlington, Vermont. Harry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had a question regarding, I wanted to hear about, you know, the surprise, the absolute surprise by, I guess, the British Army, by the Continental Army, for the most part. I think, from what I understand, a lot of these battles that were fought, the British soldiers were really kind of not in awe of the Continental Army and their skill, but the fact that they were sort of crazy. And I wonder if, I think that may have contributed. They would fight, shoot, and then retreat. And then they would come back and fight, shoot, and retreat. And I wondered what your author thought of, you know, the what did the British think of that?
Well, they were certainly ready for the fight. Harry, let us pick it up. I mean, you write maybe first of all in this vein or about Bunker Hill, which everybody knows the name, but more officers on the British side lost in that fight than in the rest of the war. All the years and battles combined, I think?
No, 25% of the British officers killed or wounded during the Revolution were killed or wounded at Bunker Hill. It was massive casualties. It was psychologically shattering for the British Army. These were among their best regiments, and the officers being killed, it was comparable to what happened to a number of the noble and gentry families in the UK in 1914 and 15 in the beginning of World War I.
And the ferocity of that fighting that our caller Harry points to, that unexpected by the British, just how well-armed and determined those rebels were.
Well, they didn't like the way they were shot at from behind stone walls coming back from Concord and Lexington. And again, when the fortifications on Bunker Hill went up, they went up overnight. They couldn't believe it. There was this fortification. And again, the colonials would put these up, dig in, entrench themselves, fight very well, and then retreat. They weren't going to fight the British way. The British were foolish to fight them the British way.
Though on Bunker Hill or Breed's Hill, I think you're right. And as we know, they fought till they ran out of gunpowder.
They ran out of gunpowder after the, not quite, during the third wave coming up the hill. And Prescott, the American commander, said if they'd had the gunpowder, they would have repulsed them again. I'm sure that's true. But one footnote to that battle is the British could have flanked the Patriot position. They could have gone around it. But they had been so stung by the insult to their best regiments that when it went up overnight, it was so in your face. They marched up the hill. Very foolish.
In formation, straight up the hill, and were mowed down. Here's the song, Bunker Hill, from Mark O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the American Revolution, the year 1775, and American politics then and now with big historian, analyst Kevin Phillips. His new book is 1775, A Good Year for Revolution. Let's take a call, Kevin, from Rochester, New York. Rob is calling. Hi, Rob. You're on the air with Kevin Phillips.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of the things that struck me from hearing Kevin describe this is the level of preparation that took place over the year or year and a half before 1776. And I'm curious the way that contrasts with the seeming lack of preparation or groundwork laying that's gone on during the Arab Spring and the uprisings in the Middle East. seems that the preparation that went on may have been the key element towards the Americans being able to put together a working coalition of people that were able to actually support a war effort and continue that on. I'll take my answer off the air, please.
Thank you, Rob. Okay, Kevin, across space and time, but you're a big enough guy to do it. What about these two?
Well, I think the 13 colonies were developing in a very major way during the 25 years prior to 1775. Ties and bonds between them. There were things that separated them, but there was a growing sense of community, organizations that were active in a number of colonies, population movement between the colonies that made it possible to have more cooperation than I think the British ever expected. Now, the Arab Spring is hardly my expertise, but it strikes me that they have to operate in the old colonial framework, the boundaries of Syria, the boundaries of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are not conducive to having coherent politics or even a coherent country. And I think the great danger for the United States and for the West here is that you're finally having a level of upheaval and indignation that seems to be spreading across the region in countries that are not equipped by their boundaries and their togetherness or lack of it to handle it.
I wonder, when it comes to the Arab Spring, or for that matter, to other political movements today, there's so much attention to, you know, social media and Twitter and the sort of fast communication, mask-fast communication is possible now as a platform for political change. But maybe part of what we read in your book here is that it takes a whole lot more than communication. They had communication in 1775, not anywhere like this. But maybe there's a we're mistaking lots of chatter for the sort of groundwork of major political change these days. Maybe chatter doesn't add up to change.
Well, I think some of the chatter, to the extent you're talking about Facebook, is not serious enough chatter to create a backdrop. On the other hand, I think you do have a lot of fermentation going on in the Middle East that's forcing people to take sides over there because they can't just wish it to go away. And unfortunately, the West isn't very equipped to deal with it either. People in this country don't want more involvement in the Middle East. It's pretty clear. And I think Obama has been wise on that respect. And the Republicans seem too much like saber-rattling people, as with Iraq and other situations. But it's also clear that Americans don't see, I think, any cousinship to the Middle East, that these are people struggling for an identity like we were in 1775. Most of the people involved in fighting against the British actually came out of a British culture and spoke English. And the foreigners, people who just come in the last 20 or 30 years, many of those were from the British Isles too. So that there was a more of a cultural tie between the rebels in 1775 and the American colonies. And I think you could fairly say there is in the area from North Africa all the way over to Pakistan. That's much more mixed.
I want to bring the revolutionary lessons into American politics here. Another call for us from Springfield, Illinois. Scott's calling. Scott, you're on with Kevin Phillips. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Phillips, real honor to talk to you today.
Thank you.
You're on the same subject that I was thinking. I'm a veteran of Afghanistan, and I will tell you that as I listened to your description of the events of the 1700s, it sounds a lot like what the Taliban are doing today. Even our enemies are using exactly the same script. They've got their own shadow government. They use the same tactics to get support of their people. They use their same tactics in fighting that that we used back then. And it's just an observation. I'm not a fan of the Taliban by any stretch. They're still my enemy, but it's the same script. And I just wanted to point out those parallels.
I appreciate your call, Scott. You know, Kevin, it's not the first time or war in which Americans have looked out on those who are on the other side and seen some echo of their, at least poetically, if not more, of their old revolutionary selves.
Well, there was quite a bit of terrorism and organized suppression of loyalist minorities that went on in 1775 and 1776, too.
Like what? Give us an example of that.
Well, for example, Connecticut sent a lot of troops into New York to suppress Tory meetings and Tory militia units, or sympathetic to Toryism militia units, because Washington didn't trust the New York militia, which was half loyalist. So they sent in the Connecticut troops, and they were not gentle. So there was not just everybody together and happy and sharing the revolution. Mm-hmm. There was an awful lot of loyalty oaths and police tactics.
Scott, I appreciate your call. Stuart in Fairview, Tennessee. Stuart, you're on the air.
Tom, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And Mr. Phillips, here's my question that I want to put to you, Mr. Phillips. To me, governance is a theory, and human beings, often flawed, take that theory and put it into practice. I became very disillusioned during the Bush years, and so I read about 15 books on the American Revolution, and I feel that we have strayed from the original intent. I know that times change. I know that circumstances change, but my impression is that the founding fathers created a new nation to really bring justice to the people, to take care of the people and take into interest the concerns of the average yeoman farmer, the average human being within that society. And governments and ways of governing evolve. Where are we today? I see gridlock. I hear Mitch McConnell saying my number one job is to make sure this is a one-term president. Where are we? Is our role evolving in such a way that you think is in the best interest of America and the world, or?
Stuart, that's a big one, a mouthful right there. Let us pick it up, and thank you, Stuart. Kevin?
Well, I think the leaders of the American Revolution were generally concerned about the public, about the average American, so to speak. Not that it was as easy then to figure out who that was. And I do think that we've lost some of the level of concern and commitment to the public, and we've also lost skills. It's very hard to see. You have to discount a bit for all the historical reputations that have been blown up and burnished. But when you think of Washington and Adams and Franklin and Jefferson, you have the sense that you're looking, I won't say at pygmies today, but certainly not at their equivalents. And I do think we've lost that. I think that politics today is to get nominated is a combat, and it requires huge amounts of money. Money talks, you know, commitment to the average person walks, to paraphrase another saying. Mm. I don't think that it's on a very good track here. I don't see it getting on a very good track. I think that the entrenched Republican and Democratic, entrenched and calcified structures are not what we need. I don't know what to do about it. I'm not sanguine there's a solution.
Okay, but give a little advice and maybe pull it from your period here, 1775. These are people who didn't like the status quo, and they organized methodically, maybe brilliantly, certainly fiercely, to change things. If people want to change things and put them on a better track today, are there lessons we can take right here on how to do that?
There may be lessons in the sense that if something is important enough, it's generally something that's complex, and you can't take slogans, and you've got to be ready to work and so forth. But I have a fundamental problem here. The reason I wanted to write this book beginning in 2008 was to get away from the Republicans and Democrats. I didn't think that they were on track to achieve very much. In some respects, I think we were at a stage of American, I don't want to say decline, but
but downward, you've already said it.
Yeah, a downward trajectory that you couldn't do too much about. And I go back and I look, and I did for two decades at what happened to the Spanish and Dutch and British. And people talked about it, and people understood the problem. But essentially, they had these entrenched capitals, entrenched governments, entrenched parties, entrenched interest groups, and they couldn't surmount them. And there had to be a crisis, and then finally change was forced, but it was painful and slow. I think we're at a stage in American development where the system really can't handle what it has to handle. And I'm not sure where you go from there.
But Americans have been very determined and methodical before in addressing big problems. They were right here. Okay, so you don't like the system as it is. What about getting in there methodically, carefully, determinedly to analyze it, change it?
One of the problems here, and I've spent a lot of time, and I've certainly mentioned this in five or six books, looking back at Spanish and, more to the point, Dutch and British history in these late stages where they hit all these problems, there was not a solution. In other words, they had to go through the historical process of losing their global preeminence, of having their structures that grew up around that preeminence challenged, of not being able to handle their debts, of being overstretched around the world. They didn't have solutions. That's the problem. At a certain point, maybe you don't.
Is it because vested interests stand in the way of seeing them? I mean, that's not a just because. That's a big deal, but
I'm afraid that's a good part of the explanation. It's quite clear if you go back and you look at the institutions in those countries, that the very success of those institutions and interest groups over the previous 100, 150 years was then an obstacle to them being able to make the sort of changes necessary when a whole lot of situations turned adverse.
Boy, Kevin Phillips, we hope there's a little more light in there than that. We're going to look for it. Jeff in Methuen, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Tom.
Good to have you. What's your question?
To say that I disagreed with Stuart and that we've moved on from that now, but I just felt like if you look at the founders and what they were trying to do, it is clear to me that their efforts were not primarily to protect the yeoman farmer, but rather to protect property to interests, and that the course of our history, and especially industrialization, has really solidified that stance for our people, much to the detriment of common folks. And that you can really tell what the politicians' values are now by, you know, very directly. They constantly talk about, you know, people being able to buy things and not necessarily doing what is right or what is honorable. And specifically, they never mention honor, and that has been out of the equation for hundreds of years.
Jeff, our time is short. Kevin Phillips, how about it? How idealistic do you see them looking back then, and what about our economic constraints now or interests?
Well, I would say that obviously a lot of them represented interests that weren't the average poor to middling colonial. That's absolutely right. However, the structure of money controlling politics today is just absolutely without precedent in our history or anybody's history. The rise of finance to national preeminence has also made finance the major procurer of the money that influences politics. I don't know how you get beyond this. The Democrats are supposed to be the party of the common people, yet Obama got a lot of his money in 2008 by carrying the cash donations of 15 or 17 of the 20 richest zip codes in the United States. You have the Republicans almost slobber over their upper bracket interests, and we can't have higher taxes on millionaires. I mean, why not? But the two parties are just part of a system which they can't get out of, and office holders can't get out of.
You write that you went back to 1775 to find refreshment in this era of political disappointment. Did you find it there, Kevin?
Well, I found it sort of. I didn't have to think about people like Newt Gingrich and Herman Cain and what's her name, Bachman. I didn't have to comment on them or talk about them. I didn't have to explain why Obama was the first Democrat to violate the principles of Jefferson, Jackson, and FDR in terms of dealing with banks. He just kowtowed. And I'm glad I didn't have to deal with it. But I don't feel that I've escaped it.
It is all around us. Speaking of all around us, we're sitting here broadcasting from Boston. You've got General Thomas Gage writing to Lord Barrington, June 1775, right in the middle of your year. Speaking of Boston, I wish this cursed place was burned. Major, major anchor of the revolution in Boston, major thorn in the side of the British.
Well, it was worse than that. Boston was a total, total trap for the British. I've got a chapter called The Battle of Boston, and I feel the Battle of Boston started in 1774 when the British sent all the troops, ended when they vacated 2 years later. It was a crushing defeat for the British.
The new book is 1775, A Good Year for a Revolution. Kevin Phillips, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we'll look at a murder-suicide in the NFL, Kansas City Chiefs, and a big spotlight on domestic violence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.